The Joint Committee on Student Success Subcommittee is open. Our plan for tonight is we have invited testimony, and we'll hear a presentation from Oregon Business and Industry, and then we're going to have some discussion. LRO has a little bit of briefing materials for us on value-added taxes. Last time, we talked a bit about principles, and we had four, five, six ideas kind of to chew on for a while. And Senator Benz was invited to add on to those, if he so choose, and he did choose to. So he's got a handout up here, and Senator Benz, if you'd care to go over those and tell us what you're thinking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I do that, I want to apologize to the committee with emphasis on Representative Smith Warner. I let my frustration with the topic get away from myself, and I don't want to do that again. So, although I can't really promise that won't happen again, but that was unfortunate, and I'll do my best to restrain my opinions, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and Representative Warner. Now, having said that, I think my frustration could be traced back, because I give it considerable thought, to what I believe is a difference in approach to this challenging $2 billion discussion we're having. And I think with the foundation of that difference is captured perhaps in the principles that I have listed here, the additional ones. And what it boils down to is this. It seems to me that the approach we can use here is one of let's just go get the money, or based on kind of a punitive sort of a, you know, businesses are just making too much and they need to pay more, so therefore just take it from them. That's one approach. The other approach, which I think is preferable if possible, is reflected in the list of principles I put together, which basically say, hey, it should be tax reform. It should be making Oregon more attractive to business, not less. The design should make Oregon more competitive, not less competitive. We should take full advantage of federal tax policy. The tax should take into account other taxes and expenses businesses are paying. The means and costs of collecting tax have to be addressed. The new or increased tax actual incidence needs to be understood. The impact of the tax must be addressed in light of other costs of business imposed by government. And if possible, the tax should be on consumption, not production. And of course, when discussing any new tax burden, we need to take into account other actions of this body recently and perhaps even in this session. So what that reflects, of course, is, Mr. Chair, is a sensitivity toward those who are going to be paying the tax, which I think is extraordinarily important in all of our conversations. And it may have been present in any event. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just say this may not be all the principles. So there may be some more things we should take into account. And as a matter of, and to address this before someone else does, some of these should be considerations, not principles. So I could have divided it into pieces, but I decided I would not.
I agree with that. Some of these are just things you should do. And I appreciate your statement about the sensitivity to business. I think we were there. We'd like to think we were there. At least I know in 2017 on that crusade that was in my mind. So thank you. Any questions of Senator Benz on
Mr. Chair? Because we saw the previous list. Is this an add-on? You added on things to the previous list, or you replaced it?
Actually, what I did, Senator, is I took the first set, which is A through G, mm-hmm. and I refined those in a way that I thought made them, what I tried to do, as any wordsmithing lawyer would do, is to take those and state them in the way I thought they were meant to be. They may not be. So, for example, in the very first one, it did read the revenue should be dedicated to successful schools. I took that and said the revenue raised from whatever source that might be will be dedicated to the purpose of funding schools to make them a better place to achieve their purpose. Mm-hmm. And that was to avoid the odd structure of the sentence. Mm-hmm. If those are incorrect, then people should go and, you know, beat them up. Anyway, that was the idea.
Okay, thank you.
And just so you know, to journalists sitting here, the words wordsmithing lawyers is just a little sort of scary. So.
Oxymoronish.
I'm not getting paid by the word, sadly.
and we do have your principles, what you just added here, into OLIS. It's on the record. Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Benz, for providing this alternative wording for us to take a look at. I really appreciate it. Just from looking at it quickly, I haven't had a chance to read each one of them. It looks like it's all very carefully worded, and I appreciate that. And I will look forward to comparing this to all the other kinds of things that we talked about at our last meeting. We've now got A through Q. I wonder if we'll get to Z, and then maybe we go to double A or A prime. But thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, let's call up OBI and your panel. Sandra, Tom.
Chair Haas and Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I'm Sandra McDonough, and I'm President and CEO of Oregon Business and Industry, and I'm joined by my colleague Mike Stober, who is our policy director specializing in tax and fiscal policy. As you know, OBI is the largest statewide business organization. We have about 1,600 businesses that are members, and they employ close to 300,000 Oregonians. Our members cover virtually every industry in Oregon, and more than 80% of them are small businesses with fewer than 100 employees. There are several issues before the legislature that we're watching very carefully this year on behalf of our members, including the work by the Joint Committee on Student Success to both improve student outcomes and your efforts to raise revenue. In fact, I have to say we deeply appreciate the work of the Joint Committee on Student Success and your effort to improve Oregon's education system. We agree that there is a need for additional education investments so that we create better potential for all the students in Oregon. And we also agree that additional revenue makes sense and is necessary. A few things will matter to us. First of all, we care about where the money will be invested to maximize the benefit to Oregonians. Second, we care about how the revenue will be raised, which is our discussion today. Third, we believe and will continue to say that raising new revenue without dealing with the underlying cost issues is not a sustainable way to fix our education system. And finally, we're concerned about the cumulative costs of all of the different very large policy issues that you're looking at in this session. On revenue, we have raised concerns about the gross receipts tax model. We believe that kind of a tax system is deeply flawed, particularly because of the economic distortions caused by the pyramiding characteristics of a GRT, no matter how low you set the rate. The tax pyramiding results in inequities because some products and processes end up with a different effective tax rate than others. Mike Stober will walk you through how that works. But I will say that many of our members remain deeply opposed to a GRT because of that pyramiding impact. As we've raised this concern about the GRT over the last few years, many of you have challenged us to come to the table with an alternative option, which we thought was fair. So we're doing that now. For the last year, the Oregon Business and Industry has been working with our partners under the Oregon Business Plan to develop an alternative revenue option that could be deployed to fund targeted investments. We refer to our option as the business activity tax. It is a form of a broad-based consumption tax with a base that is calculated by subtracting purchases from other businesses from the gross receipts. We contracted with the consultants at the State Tax Research Institute to develop the business activities tax option, which for many companies works better than a GRT. And again, Mike will walk you through the technical aspects of how it works. For us, this is still a research project. We have convened partners, business organizations to work with us, and we are developing a tool that will enable businesses, including our members, to calculate what the potential tax might be from both the business activities tax model and from a GRT model. What we want to be well prepared to do is to answer your questions about how businesses will react to the different options. I expect that this evening, your question to me will be whether we are ready to endorse a new tax based on our model. And my answer will be that it's too early to say that. Today, we are talking about broad concepts. We don't know yet how this tax option or any other will ultimately look in terms of rates, exclusions, and other really important details. And we don't know what other changes you might make to Oregon tax code that will impact our members. Until we have the complete picture, I can't say where we will be. But I will tell you this, we are committed to being part of the conversation. It's the reason we proactively developed the business activity tax model and why we have spent the last year traveling the state to discuss the issues with legislators, chambers of commerce, businesses, industry associations, and stakeholders. And before I turn it over to Mike, I want to touch on one other issue. We are committed to being part of the revenue discussion, as I said, and we believe that we need to work with you to improve education funding so we can improve outcomes for our students. But we also want to make sure that the dollars get to the classrooms and programs that will make a difference. This biennium, and for many biennium after. And that's why we will continue to stress that you must address the state's structural budget deficit, starting with the rising cost of the public employee retirement system. As this chart shows, increasing costs of PERS will consume much of the new revenue from a $2 billion education funding package, and that doesn't even count the cost of PERS to local governments. We believe there are legal, meaningful steps that the legislature can take to slow the growth of PERS costs, including passing Senator Knope's Employee Choice and Shared Responsibility Act. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Mike to walk through the business activities tax.
Thank you, Sandy. Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the subcommittee. My name is Mike Stober. As Sandy mentioned, I'm the Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy at Oregon Business and Industry. As we saw just a minute ago, we know the subcommittee has established or is in the process of establishing guiding principles for your work this session. OBI has done the same thing for our engagement with you. We've got a few on the slide here that I'll point out. These are the principles that we'll use as we evaluate revenue proposals over the next few months. The first is a broad base with no favorites among industries, a level playing field, similar impacts among competitors. We want a system that recognizes the needs of low margin businesses, one that supports economic employment and wage growth, and one that reduces volatility of state revenues and promotes stability through reserves and fiscal discipline. As Sandy mentioned, the business activity tax model we have developed with our partners in the Oregon Business Plan is a value-added or a consumption-based tax that equals total sales minus business input purchases, including all capital purchases. This is a subtraction method concept as opposed to the additive New Hampshire business enterprise tax that the committee discussed last week as well as earlier this week. The business activity tax would apply to every business, no matter how it's structured. That includes both C-Corps as well as pass-through entities. The business activity tax would follow the 100% destination sales apportionment market sourcing concept. This means that Oregon businesses exporting to other states or countries will not have to pay the business activity tax on the revenue it gets from those exports. It also means that businesses located in other states selling into Oregon would have to pay the business activity tax on those Oregon sales. There are a good number of other policy and political decisions to be made in designing a business activity tax, but there are some important features we believe it should have. The first is an exemption for small businesses, those with less than $500,000 in gross receipts in Oregon. This avoids placing an unnecessary financial and administrative burden on firms with relatively few sales in the state. We also believe the tax should exempt government services, charities, public nonprofit colleges and universities, as well as financial services and insurance companies. States that have implemented versions of a business activity tax in the past have typically exempted financial services and insurance because their main costs of doing business are interest paid to depositors and lost payments to policyholders. Those are payments to, obviously, to individuals, not to other businesses. It wouldn't be deductible from the business activity tax base.
So not an exemption as a tax break, but just because of the nature of the work.
The nature of the business, correct. And so financial services firms and insurance companies would be, in our model, subject to the current corporate tax income tax regime. Nothing would change. Finally, just as with the corporate income tax, companies would be able to take a negative business activity tax liability and carry that forward for a period of 20 years in order to offset future business activity tax.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. How many years?
20.
20 years.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Here's how a business activity tax would work for a business. You'd take a grocery store, for example. The grocery would take the revenue generated from all its sales at the register and subtract all its purchases from other businesses. That includes its inventory, groceries, as well as the actual physical shelves, the checkout stands, its electric and water utility payments, etc. The dollar amount that remains would be multiplied by the business activity tax rate to determine the grocery's business activity tax. So if you contrast that with the gross receipts tax, which is applied to the same product at the same rate in every stage of the process from initial production to the consumer shelf. And that's in that system, a gross receipts system, the tax compounds or pyramids. As Sandy said, many of OBI's members are opposed to a gross receipts tax due to the economic distortions the pyramiding effect creates. The only detailed study we're aware of on pyramiding is a study of the Washington Business and Occupation Tax that goes back to 2002. However, the lessons still apply today. That study found that the pyramiding effect resulted in an average effective tax rate 2.5 times the statutory rate for Washington State. There's also, as you can see, a pretty wide variation across industries. The multiplier for food manufacturing is 6.7, 4.1 for apparel and textile manufacturing, 3.3 for construction, and so on there. So that's Washington State. However, we also had our consultants at the State Tax Research Institute look at an Oregon-specific example. Under gross receipts tax, an Oregon transportation equipment manufacturer will face an estimated pyramiding ratio of 3.85. That means the manufacturer will effectively pay almost 4 times the rate set in law by the time the consumer buys the product, the end product. Another way to look at this is the difference in total taxes under business activity tax and under gross receipts tax. Assuming tax rates that generate the same amount of total economy-wide revenue, keeping all things equal there, that would be a 1% rate for business activity tax and a 0.384% rate for gross receipts tax. The transportation equipment manufacturing industry in Oregon would pay 3.2 times more taxes under a gross receipts tax as it would a business activity tax. Shows you some of the distortions that creates there. The pyramiding that results from a gross receipts tax could also put Oregon businesses at a competitive disadvantage relative to out-of-state businesses, those selling into Oregon. If the out-of-state business's supply chain is also located out-of-state, that business would only be taxed on the final sale into Oregon. In contrast, an Oregon business with an in-state supply chain would be subject to pyramiding and be forced to charge a higher price for the final product or accept a lower margin. As a result of these same dynamics, Oregon consumers may, where possible, be inclined to purchase goods and services from businesses that aren't located in the state because they would be cheaper. The pyramiding that results from a gross receipts tax may also incent Oregon businesses to either vertically integrate or source from outside of the state, neither of which are a desirable outcome in our mind. And then, again, because a business activity tax is not subject to pyramiding, it would not be subject to the same economic distortions. Given the conversations that have occurred in the subcommittee over the last couple of weeks, I'd like to take a brief moment and just address a couple of potential questions before taking any others you may have. The first is, does this tax penalize hiring by taxing labor? And the short answer is no. Labor is not a purchase from another business, and so it's not deducted from a business activity tax base. However, a firm's business activity tax does not automatically increase when they hire a new employee under our model. It should also be noted that labor costs are not deducted from a gross receipts tax. Second question there is the business activity tax subject to avoidance? Remember, the business activity tax is gross receipts minus purchases from other firms. So the only way to avoid a business activity tax would be to purchase more from other firms, which we believe is a good thing. And even in that scenario, the firm that's selling the goods and services would be subject to the business activity tax. It's designed to capture 100% of value added. It's just a matter of where in the production chain that's captured. Third question there is, will it be hard to implement a business activity tax? As with any tax, it will take time to implement a new business activity tax. Once in place, though, it should be easier to administer than a corporate income tax. It may be slightly easier to administer a gross receipts tax, but given what we've shown today, we believe that will come at a significant economic cost. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening. Please know that OPI would like to continue to serve as a constructive participant in these conversations. And to that end, as Sandy mentioned, we would also hope that this subcommittee does not view its work in isolation. This is very important work, but it must be examined in the context of the cumulative impact of actions taken by the legislature this session. New revenue for Medicaid funding, cap and trade, education has potential to significantly increase the cost of doing business in Oregon going forward. Thank you again, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. It means a great deal to me personally and to this committee to have your engagement, and I understand you're advocating for this approach, but not necessarily for a final product.
And, right.
We do want to talk about this approach for a while. That's kind of what we're doing tonight. So if you could hang with us here, and I'll open up the floor. Do you have any questions here, Senator Berg?
Thank you. Is there any state that is doing the business activity tax the way you envision it?
Not currently. Michigan, and with their single business tax, had a version of this for on and off for approximately 45 years.
And they still have it?
Co-chairs and Senator Burdick, no, they do not.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Do you know why they got rid of it?
Co-chair Hess, Co-chair Nathanson, Senator Burdick. Yes, it was a political decision. Given the leadership at the top of the state at the time, they had a distaste for the tax when they were in private industry, and the governor ultimately pushed through a repeal of the tax.
Okay, and no state since then has adopted this?
Co-chair Hass, Co-chair Nathanson, Senator Burdick, not this specific subtraction model.
Mike, you said purchases from other firms. Is that phrase synonymous with cost of goods sold?
Co-Chair Hass, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. No, my understanding is labor would be considered included in cost of goods sold, too. So the labor is not included as a purchase from another business.
Is that your understanding?
I thought
labor was out of cost of goods sold.
Sometimes there can be a piece of labor.
That really is a kind of a very subjective category, is what you put in those deductions. We've talked a little bit here the other night about one of the Texas options only has payroll. Another one of the options has cost of goods sold. In a little while from now, we'll look at the pros and cons of doing either.
Okay.
But just wondering how open you are about changing or mixing and matches those categories of deductions, like, for example, payroll versus purchases from other firms.
Chair Hess, I think it's fair to say we'd like to engage with you as you analyze it and understand it, and we will look at all options with you.
All right.
Go ahead. Yes.
The current corporate income tax, this would be added to or replace.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, I think what we would look at is we're hoping that if we're talking about tax reform, that you're going to be looking at it at broadly and at all of the different taxes there, and we would be looking for some adjustments on the other taxes that impact businesses and residents of Oregon, so corporate income tax and personal income tax as well.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you very much.
First of all, thank you for the presentation. I want to mention that I especially appreciate the slide. The title is Potential Questions. It's obvious you've been listening to our conversations and looking at our concerns and addressing very directly the issue of does or does it not penalize hiring by taxing labor? Is it subject to tax avoidance? Will it be hard to implement? So thank you for listening to those items that we're calling out as things that we know we need to consider, and you're addressing those head on in your analysis in what you're proposing, whether it does or doesn't have an impact on what we're thinking about. Speaking of one of the points you made specifically, pyramiding disadvantaging Oregon businesses who are competing with businesses selling into Oregon. Could you provide me two or three pretty specific examples of either a tangible or intangible, something that there's an Oregon business producing right now? It's either a thing you can hold or it's software you've developed and you're selling. Could you provide just two or three examples where an Oregon business would be directly disadvantaged by someone you know selling the same, pretty much the same type of product into Oregon?
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, and Mike's a technical guy, so he might kick me as I do this, but let's think about food that is produced outside of Oregon and brought into Oregon by a distributor and sold in a store versus food that is produced in Oregon and sold in a store. If it's produced in Oregon from the producer to the distributor to the store, in a gross receipts tax, it's going to be hit a few times, whereas it comes from out of state, you don't have that initial place where it, the tax is implemented. So you might miss a couple of spots on the pyramiding, which reduces the tax incident. Is that fair?
That's correct.
I was thinking of chicken.
And I assume that this is more true for things, where there's a lot of processing, value added, for example. Buying an apple is different than buying apple pie. Thank you. Frozen apple pie.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I think the more it's processed, the more you have the potential for an incident of taxation. But even with an apple, they're going to go from the orchard to maybe a co-op and then to a distributor and then to the store. So you're likely to have several incidents of taxation.
Do you have a non-food product to describe?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Hass, in general, any product with multiple steps in the supply chain, and take the chair you're sitting in right now, if the components of the chair are manufactured in state and ultimately assembled in state, that the gross receipts tax will be tacked on at each level in the production process, where if the whole chair is simply imported into the state, it's only the final sale.
I absolutely understand the concept. I'm envisioning in Oregon's overall economy, agriculture is a significant share, and I'm picturing what share of our economy, for example, manufacturing of apparel, parts for mechanical equipment, batteries, for example.
Right.
However, Oregon is a small state, and the amount of product manufactured is also small compared to what's coming into Oregon. What about intellectual property or intangibles?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Hass, members of the committee, yes, if there are not a lot of business inputs, so think of services or technology companies, it won't be subject to as much pyramiding. There's not as much. So in that light, yes, an Oregon business would not be at a disadvantage relative to an out-of-state competitor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Rep. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, thank you both for being here. Couple things. Number one, could you and I'm not sure how involved you were in the development of this, but could you talk a little bit about why or how you came to the idea of it being a subtractive process instead of an additive one?
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner. You're right. I wasn't involved. That decision predated me at and as well as Sandy at Oregon Business and Industry. But it in part gets to the question which the subcommittee raised last week about taxing labor, and you have the New Hampshire Business Enterprise tax model where it's the additive approach, and it's pretty clear if you add labor costs, you're adding to your business activity tax base. And so we in part designed it so that that would not be the case.
Okay, thank you. And if I can ask another question. One of our principles, I hesitate to use that word, but one of the principles that's occurred on more than one of the lists is, and that's important to me, is progressivity. So can you talk at all about how progressive you would posit this, that this is or is not?
Co-Chair Ask, Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner. A consumption tax, and maybe LRO should weigh in here too, getting beyond my area of expertise, but a consumption tax in general is a regressive tax. And so that is something we have given serious thought to. And we would hope that if a tax along these lines were adopted, it would be paired with either reductions in personal income tax rates or other deductions or credits for low income individuals to ensure that the tax wasn't the overall package wasn't regressive.
Thank you.
Senator Benz.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair. I think you mentioned that you weren't taking a final position pending what we do this session. And one of the things we've been working on a lot is the cap and trade system that would affect Oregon's manufacturing sector, just like everybody else. And about 22% of Oregon GDP comes from manufacturing. So if we do that, if we put a cap and trade system in place that imposes a cost on business, how would that factor into your decision regarding this this business activities tax?
Senator Benz, we are continuing to watch all of the major legislative packages that are being considered in this session and the cumulative cost to the business taxpayers, but as well as personal taxpayers. We are concerned about some of the costs that we see potential from in cap and trade, particularly natural gas increases that we see potential for, as well as some fuel costs. So as we speak to you as the session progresses, we will be talking about the cumulative tax that is coming forward, and hopefully that you all are considering the cumulative impact on businesses and our ability to grow jobs in Oregon.
Follow up. So this takes us to the concern that if we add this new tax to our current tax burden of business in Oregon, we would add to that assertion that I've heard many, many times that Oregon is not a business-friendly state. Thus, the tax reform concept comes into play. What would you suggest we do to, if we adopt this, to offset it, modify it, soften its impact, so that we don't worsen what might already be a bad perception of our business environment?
Senator, as I said, what we hope is that instead of looking at just one new tax by itself, that you're looking at overall tax reform and understanding how it all works together, so that the signal that is ultimately sent to business is that you want us here and investing in growing jobs in Oregon. So looking at the total package as well as all of the other issues that are being considered in the session that will create additional costs for Oregonians.
One of the issues we discussed at the last meeting had to do with the fact that Oregon has one of the lowest corporate rates in the nation. And I brought up the fact that that might not be capturing all of the mandates, for example, that are imposed upon Oregon's business. Do you guys have studies or something that indicates what might be a clearer picture of that which Oregon business is paying in addition to corporate taxes, so that we can in some fashion measure what that business person is thinking and understand it better?
Do you want to address that, Mike?
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Benz, we are in the middle of putting something exactly along those lines together. It's not finished, but as soon as it is, we'll be happy to share it with the subcommittee.
And Senator, if I might add, it's important to remember that we do have the corporate tax rate, but many businesses pay under different schedules, and they pay under our personal income tax rate, which is high relative to the rest of the nation. So, yeah, not all businesses are the same in how they're treated by the tax code.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. And conversely, have you done any analysis of the impact of the federal tax reduction, which was significant for all levels of businesses, pass-throughs, Schedule C corporations, and all corporate entities? Have you kind of, for lack of a better phrasing, have you figured out how much more room you have for tax burden to put toward Oregon programs that are so important to the future business climate, like education?
Senator, I think what we've said is that we're here because we're ready to talk to you about new revenue for education, and we want to be part of the conversation. I'm not aware of any Oregon-specific study of the impact of federal tax rates, but I would point out that those tax breaks are the same for all 50 states. And so when you have a business that's deciding whether they're investing more in Oregon or more in Arizona, what happens with the Oregon tax policy is what's important at the end of the day. So, but we are here, and we do want to engage with you about revenue for education in Oregon.
Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you. One of the other points that has come up among us, or even just generally in conversation, is everyone contributing? Is everyone in the game? You know, and one of your slides explains a small business exemption would be proposed by you, other exemptions, and companies with a negative business activity tax. But generally, under your I hesitate to call it a proposal. It's not necessarily got all the I's dotted and T's crossed. But under this type of plan that you would present, do you feel like everyone's in, or you're just hoping that those who aren't in the game, financial services and insurance, they're covered somewhere else, and you're assuming we're keeping those other places where they might be taxed or otherwise participating in supporting the infrastructure of the state?
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Nathanson, yes, at its outset, it's designed to be very broad. It's to include as many businesses as possible. The exemptions that were included on that slide are typical exemptions in these types of system, either for the administrative burden for a small business to comply with the tax, or for the complexities involved in the nature of the industry as it is in financial services and insurance. But yes, this option raises revenue from a wide range of industries.
Could I follow up?
Yes.
You mentioned the complexity for determining how something might apply in the financial services and insurance sector. Could you expand on that for me, please? Because there are probably a lot of businesses that will say, well, this is really complicated for me to figure out. So how complicated? How much more complicated? And why is there not a way to have everyone participate, assuming that they're over the $500,000 threshold, for example?
Co-chair asks, Co-chair Nathanson, you could design a program that applies a business activity tax to financial services and insurance companies. Complexity may have been the wrong word to use there. It's more to do with the nature of their business. Your traditional manufacturing company is purchasing a lot of other inputs from other businesses. Most of the expenses in financial services firms and insurance companies are going to interest to deposit holders or to pay for a loss claim on the insurance side. Those aren't payments to other businesses, so that effectively overstates, if you think about the value-added concept, overstates the value-added that those firms are adding, in our opinion.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Senator Benz, you have that look.
Yeah, well, I have way too many questions, Mr. Co-Chair, but thank you. I'll just ask one. So the tax is, it pays no attention to net income. It's an activities tax. You're here, you pay. And that suggests a certain level where you wouldn't be exposed to that type of cost with no regard to whether you're making money. Do you guys have was it $500,000? Where was your, did you have a suggested starting point for this tax? Did you take it right down to zero? Or did you say, well, wait a minute, a small business, there's a real issue as to how much money it's actually making and can it pay?
Senator, we would suggest that $500,000 would be a starting point, that companies that make or have less than $500,000 in revenue should not be subject to the tax because it's a small business and we think it would be unduly burdensome on them.
Thank you.
This has been a good discussion. Hope we can continue. We got the lines of communications open, and we're going to continue slogging through this. So thank you for your help coming down tonight. We also invited another group that's working on this, the Coalition for Common Good, and Logistics Conspired, to require them to come next week with their presentation. So.
Great.
We'll hear from them next week.
If we're able to meet, Mr.
Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Snow. He's worried about snow.
Ellipse number 7.
So at this point, we're going to kind of continue talking about value-added tax scenario. Chris, you've been looking at some charts and some different things to keep in the back of your mind or in the front of your mind as we examine, okay, if it's additive or subtractive, and if you're going to do it, what makes sense, what industries are affected the most by your choices?
So, Chair Haas, members of the committee, so the chart that's in OLIS is titled, I think, Federal Sectors. And the idea, this is supposed to be just illustrative, it's federal data from tax year 2013.
I was going to say.
Not 23 BC.
Imagine.
23.
Tax year 20.
23.
So Jesus could have helped us out.
We'll need all the help we can get.
I'll try that again.
Reset.
Tax year 2013, for all businesses, it's federal data. And as the committee is discussing and thinking about these issues, going from the gross receipts down to the income and everything that's in the middle for a value-added tax or a business activity tax, and what gets taken out of there. So I'm looking at the federal data and look at cost of goods sold divided by business receipts. And then payroll, I was using the term compensation before that was causing some confusion, so I have payroll here. So it's labor costs as a percent of receipts. And as you heard in the presentation, there are always some nuances to the data. So for example, the one that was raised here, the cost of goods sold, I believe does include a piece of labor. I'm working on how to pull that out. Some of the information I have right now indicates that that might be around 5%, but I don't know exactly what that is. So just to keep that in mind, we are limited by available data. We always have data limitations. And see, so these are from federal tax returns. The idea here is illustrative between subtracting cost of goods sold and the labor costs and how that would affect different sectors differently. So the theme, just from a quick glance at the charts, cost of goods sold as a percent of receipts is much higher for certain sectors than others, and those are, you know, retail trade, wholesale trade. You'll hear some of those examples, and then manufacturing and construction are some of the largest. So for all of the business receipts that a given company has, if they're operating in those sectors, the stuff that they're buying to produce their output is a larger share than in some of the service sectors. And then if you bounce over to the payroll as a percent of receipts, that's where those costs, it's almost, reversed isn't quite the right term, but for the retail trade, wholesale trade, manufacturing and construction, those sectors, their payroll as a percent is down in the 10% range, whereas their cost of goods sold as a percent is, call it in the 70% range, just broad strokes. And then the payroll as a percent of receipts for some of the services sectors, so you have professional, scientific, and technical. And the one that really jumps out there is management of companies. These are holding companies. And their payroll is just about 90% compared. So they're the outlier there. But whether we're talking about healthcare, social assistance, educational services, services, their payroll as a percent of receipts are 35%. And when you look at their cost of goods sold, in percentage terms, they're down to, you know, 5 or 10% in some of those sectors. So just as the committee is thinking about which tax and which model to go with, at some point, I mean, we've just had that very high level discussion about the size of the tax base. You know, $300 billion for gross receipts. You know, maybe $100 billion for some kind of value added tax, and then you get down to $10 billion for an income tax. So that's the first swipe of that tax base, keeping in mind the lever being the tax rate needed to hit a certain revenue target, all things equal. Then the next question is how are the different services or the sectors affected? And that's really, this is just meant to be illustrative. Oregon will look different in terms of its industrial mix. And then another factor that comes into play is apportionment, which was part of the presentation you just heard. It's borrowing from our corporate income tax where we have a single sales factor, and it's taking that value-added base and apportioning that down to Oregon. And so it's kind of a mix of a couple of different policies. So that was really the intent, just to give some food for thought on the sectoral.
Well, to me, it's a little counterintuitive. I would have thought that the payroll would be a bigger percentage. And I know this is a federal model, but you can see the sectors that would, I don't want to say benefit, but would benefit above payroll as opposed to cost of goods sold. This still casts the wider net, brings in firms who are not paying into Oregon now, don't have nexus here, sometimes referred to the flyover companies.
Correct. The idea would be that we didn't really talk about the nexus, and I'd have to think about exactly how that would work, but you'd have a company that operates in multiple states, and you would calculate their value added or their business activity base, and then by apportioning that to Oregon, I think that would pick them up, some of those flyover businesses, as you said.
And the
management of companies, I realize this is, that feels more New York or Delaware, not so much, or we're holding companies.
Yeah, I don't know exactly which holding companies would be in Oregon, but.
Okay. Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. So Chris, the do you have the chart that shows us? I know I've seen it. These same areas called out as their portion of our economy. So you know, retail, for example. You know what I mean? So we could then see who it is that has the greatest exposure, but in relative terms, to this particular tax. In other words, I know that someone has told me in the carbon discussions that that manufacturing is 22% of our GDP. So it'd be great to see where everybody fits. The retail one is really interesting. So Walmart, Amazon, those kinds of companies would, it'd be great to see what's happening there. You have it because I know, I remember you showing it to us sometime.
I can present that for next week, yeah.
And then there's a thought, excuse me, Mr. Chair. May I, yeah,
yes.
I need to think more about this before I ask the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to ask Chris this question. I'm just looking at this and thinking about pyramiding, which we talk a lot about in the gross receipts model, and whether you can draw any kind of analogies between the percentage of cost of goods as the percentage of receipts and high pyramiding. Opportunity, whether the more, which you would argue the more inputs, that's the theory, is the more pyramiding one might be subject to. Me doing some high level theoretical thinking about how we translate this stuff. You know, I do a lot of that, Senator Benz.
I'm not sure you can go from this chart to an estimate of the pyramiding. I mean, I guess I'd have to think about that from the cost of goods sold.
Is there some sort of, yeah.
I think it depends on the supply chain and the output markets for the different individual companies. It could vary a lot within a different sector, I would suppose.
Right.
One broad way to think about that is from the information that was provided earlier about a $300 billion base for gross receipts, and if it's a $100 billion base for the VAT, that's where you get that 3-to-1, which is similar to some of the information you heard in the prior presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Chris, this is a little bit too ethereal, maybe, but I'm trying to see what the difference would be when you compare a gross receipts tax to a value-added tax like this. If you have, say, manufacturing company X has a $50,000 tax bill under a VAT tax at 1.5%, and a $50,000 tax bill under a gross receipts tax at 0.20%. Is there any difference? Is there an advantage to one over the other if their tax bill ends up being the same?
I guess it depends on. At the bottom, at the end of the day, I think the tax is just a cost to the business, and it depends on the final incidence of that tax and whether or not they would pass along to their consumers. And it could affect some of where they might get some of their inputs or where they're selling to. But I'm not sure if how the business would view those fundamentally differently.
All right. Under this model here with that 80%, cost of goods sold as a percentage of receipts on manufacturing, does this help them with their suppliers who would be subject to this tax and therefore prices would go up for the supplies?
Help them with their suppliers?
Does this defray what potential increases there would be, say, for example, under a straight grocery seats tax.
Oh, in terms of having a subtraction for the cost of
yes.
goods sold?
Yes.
Yeah, that would, I mean, that reduces the tax base for them. So, yeah.
That wasn't a very well thought out question. Thank you, though. Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The, Chris, the, you had shown us that in other states there had been an adjustment of the height of the tax depending upon the nature of the business, which went, I think, to the marginal or not, you know, how much they were making, their profit. I think that's how those, was it Nevada? I forgot which one, but you gave us a list and each one had a different right. tax.
Yeah.
And what was that? That was based on what? Their what?
That was the total business. That was I believe you're referring to the study by cost.
Yes.
And it was a sum of the business taxes, so the main business taxes, sales tax, property tax, income tax, some licenses. I don't think it included fees, but it was the business taxes divided by private sector GSP, gross state product. So it took all of those taxes attributable to the business. So it included the corporate income tax. It included estimates of the personal income tax that were paid by pass-through entities, sales taxes, property taxes, for all of the states, and then took that total and divided by the private sector GDP.
I think the one I'm thinking of is the state had gone into these spaces and there wasn't just an across-the-board percentage of tax. There was each area paid a different rate. And I forgot which one of the states that was. But if you were in a low margin business, your tax was lower. If you're in a higher margin business, your tax was higher. And there was a lot of negotiations, and I want to say it was Nevada.
But Washington has.
Washington B&O.
Is that what it is?
Has
different
resilience.
They have different
yes. all kinds yeah. of. Yeah, so what yeah. was that?
The Washington B&O had different rates.
Yes, what were they based on, that differential? Why were they different?
I think it was part of, it's tied to the pyramiding study that was referenced before.
Oh, I get the likelihood of pyramid had nothing to do with profit.
Well, those might be tied in together. And so like for the B&O tax, the baseline service rate, tax rate is 1.5%. And then for other sectors, it's like 0.484%.
Right.
And then you get into a lot of a difference. They had another 30 different sectors with different rates.
Correct.
And the starting point there was this was trying to get at the pyramiding using a gross receipts tax, but you use varying rates to get at some of that information,
yeah.
some of that impact. And Nevada did something similar. They had, I want to say, 15 or 20 different
right.
rates. And that's a trade-off as the committee moves forward, kind of a simplicity versus the complexity as you
yeah.
try to refine. Mm-hmm. How the different industries are affected.
One thing that we discovered in 2017 was there's a lot of industries that are very low margin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being a little bit flip, but we heard that a lot. And I guess the beauty of having one rate, be it a VAT or a gross receipts tax, is it's just one rate. And because once you start doing carve-outs, then you're really setting yourself up for a lot of, you know, what potentially political decisions.
Representative
Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was going to say, if you look at the Washington one, I mean, it's a pretty clear example of a full employment act for lobbyists, I would say, in the most
mm-hmm.
respectful way. There is, I think, it does start with the, trying to get at the pyramid, and then if you read through it, it's pretty
and
clearly yes, yeah. Not if there's anything wrong with that.
No. Okay, well, this has been a really good freewheeling discussion. I appreciate your participation to OBI again. We'll have a secondary presentation next week by the other coalition, and in the meantime, we'll start sending some examples of some of these through Chris to put some numbers in, with the expectation of maybe the week after next we start putting some bones together of some basic plans to meet our deadlines.
Okay.
Does that sound reasonable? Okay. Thank you all. We adjourn.